Good morning. It is Sunday, April 27th, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Theater Squared Season 8 concludes with Hamlet, on stage now through May 4th at Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Shakespeare's epic tragedy is equal parts ghost story, political intrigue, doomed romance, and murder mystery. Tickets and information for Hamlet available at theater2.org. or by calling 443-5600.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, how little pieces of blue plastic are being recycled with Mercy Hospital. We'll go to the first tee of Northwest Arkansas in Lowell and find out how golf and life are intricately connected. Plus, we'll hear a song from Elephant Revival recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio and much more.
But first, a look back at the weekend news with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis.
The big story this week centered on U.S. Senator John Bozeman. The 63-year-old senator was hospitalized early Tuesday morning after experiencing arm and chest pain. Doctors at Mercy Hospital in Rogers conducted several tests and performed emergency surgery to correct an acute aortic dissection, or a tear in the largest artery in the body. Senator Bozeman has been recovering, and he was moved out of the intensive care unit and into a private recovery room Thursday. Patrick Creamer, a spokesperson for the senator, says that while several appearances in northern Arkansas had to be canceled, it was mostly business as usual at Senator Bozeman's Washington office.
The staff continues to work to help Arkansans with any issues they have with federal agencies and respond to legislative inquiries, and they've taken meetings up here in Washington with Arkansans that are in town, and then, of course, in the state, they're continuing to make the rounds and meet out there. So it's somewhat business as usual. We'll have hopefully have a better timeline before the Senate goes back on Monday as to, you know, when the senator could be back in Washington. But as of right now, we just don't know. So fortunately, there aren't any votes this week. We just unfortunately had to cancel a number of events that he had booked.
Aside from Senator Bozeman's health scare, though, a handful of stories regarding litigation and the state of Arkansas came to the forefront of the headlines from the past 7 days. A decision on whether Arkansas's ban on same-sex marriage will be reaffirmed or lifted is expected this coming week after litigators recently presented nearly 3 hours of oral arguments. After the proceedings, Jack Wagner, an attorney for the plaintiffs in the case, framed the court's future decision in the context of similar litigation nationally.
His ruling won't do anything on a national level beyond add to the the ever-increasing load of cases that have gone our way. You know, you saw me go over, I think, 18 different decisions, I think 14 federal courts and three state courts. All the decisions that have come out since the United States Supreme Court's decision in Windsor last June, and every single one of them has ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in those cases.
The state, represented by Assistant Attorney General Colin Jorgensen, argued that the will of voters, which was expressed in a 2004 amendment to the state's constitution, lends legitimacy to the ban. But Wagner argued previous cases affirmed that fundamental rights cannot be superseded by the will of the majority. All parties involved conceded a stay is likely if the ban is overturned, with the case likely to head to the state Supreme Court. Later on in the week, Pulaski County Circuit Judge Tim Fox struck down Arkansas's voter ID law. The Pulaski County Elections Commission brought the suit challenging just one provision of the 2013 law added in February by the State Board of Election Commissioners. The suit argued the state board overstepped its authority by implementing a rule not contained in the legislation, granting absentee voters additional time to show ID. Pulaski County Election Commissioner Chris Burks said it made sense for Judge Fox to examine the entire law.
The court looked at the law and said, yes, I've been asked to rule on this part of the law, but in considering this part of the law, I have to consider the whole law and the Constitution of Arkansas. So I think the ruling really reflects fidelity with the Arkansas Constitution.
Burks said that he expected the ruling would strike down the entirety of the law, and that any further changes to election law should wait until after the coming primary election.
It's important to consider how do you practically administer elections. And if you have a ruling taking down the entire law, then you have a stay, I think that promotes confusion. So, I think the order today was very clear, and you want to promote stability within the law. You don't want confusion. So I would hope that we can just go forward under the old law and not have the 595 be put back in place with a stay pending appeal.
Burks said that he believes the ruling finding the voter ID law presented an unconstitutional barrier to voting helps safeguard Arkansans' rights to vote. Republicans pushed for the law last year and overrode a veto by Governor Mike Beebe, saying voter ID legislation was needed to prevent voter fraud. And the Arkansas Supreme Court said that it won't reconsider its decision to reject a $1.2 billion judgment against a pharmaceutical company accused of improperly marketing an antipsychotic drug. Justices last month overturned a Pulaski County ruling that favored the state. In a 4-3 decision this past week, the court turned down a request by Attorney General Dustin McDaniel to consider the case again. McDaniel reacted to the decision in an interview with Talk Business and Politics.
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm certainly disappointed because the rationale that the court used was completely new and foreign to the case, an issue that was never raised by any of the parties over the last 7 years. And they now create, in every case in Arkansas, the potential risk of malpractice for lawyers because they say you can no longer trust what's printed in the law books. The law that we've been litigating has been printed in the red leather books for the last 21 years, and no one ever questioned it.
McDaniel also said that the court's interpretation of the law in its decisions undermines more than 170 years of precedent.
The Arkansas Supreme Court has the reputation of being a results-oriented court. They get whatever result they want, and they craft the law to match what they want done. And in this case, they came up with something that no one had even argued. It undercuts the credibility of our court, and it completely takes away from the Attorney General the ability to ever go after a drug manufacturer, no matter what they did or how guilty they are. In this case, the drug manufacturer pleaded guilty to a federal felony and paid $2.2 billion in fines, and I'm told we're never allowed to prosecute them or anyone else.
McDaniel says the court was wrong when it said the state misapplied a Medicaid fraud law in its case against Johnson & Johnson. The state had claimed the company didn't properly communicate the risks of the drug Risperdal and shouldn't have marketed it for off-label use. The company argued there was no fraud and that Arkansas's Medicaid program wasn't harmed. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
In about 16 minutes on this edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, how Don Draper and the program Mad Men can help us talk about history.
The series wove the historical events into a truth told through fiction.
Right.
Of the changes of the 1960s and the 1970s, the exact time period of
Camelot, the Kennedys.
Bingo, and civil rights, and great American unrest, and the Beatles' arrival in America notwithstanding, this year does begin a series of not so golden anniversaries. JFK's assassination in 63 begats a litany of 50s, the Gulf of Tonkin, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King.
Our history doctor, Bill Smith, comes back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about how popular culture can help us explain history to younger people and to ourselves. That conversation ahead on Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Next time on Living on Earth, pet flea collars kill fleas and ticks, but can be dangerous for the household.
When kids come in contact with their pet, which they do on a daily basis, they come into contact with that very toxic pesticide.
The EPA will ban some flea collars, but not all, and not very soon. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Listen to Living on Earth, Sundays at 5 p.m. on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Millions of people around the world celebrated Earth Day earlier this week, and Antoinette Grajeda discovered that Mercy Hospital in Northwest Arkansas is launching a new recycling effort. Here's her story.
A few years ago, Mercy, the sixth largest Catholic healthcare system in the country, started working on a green initiative. According to a news release published in April of 2010, in the span of 9 months, Mercy, which at that time included a group of 30 hospitals in Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, saved nearly $800,000 and diverted more than 20,000 pounds of waste from local landfills. Mercy Hospital, Northwest Arkansas and Rogers, has continued that commitment to sustainability. About 2 weeks ago, the hospital implemented a new program to recycle the blue wrap used to keep instruments going into an operating room sterile. The idea for the program was born from a partnership with Fayetteville-based P3 Waste Consulting. Vice President of Operations Scott Swearingen says a big part of what P3 Waste Consulting does is analyzing companies' waste streams and then figuring out if there's a more efficient way to handle it. In this instance, analysis involved a trip to the landfill.
I actually met the truck out there whenever they were dumping the compactor from the hospital. And once we got out, we suited up, biohazard suits, gloves, masks, and literally dug into the mountain of trash that came out of the compactor. And we started analyzing exactly what was in there. That's really the only way to get a sense of exactly, you know, the week's worth of trash, what it looks like.
Swearingen says they found the biggest portion of the hospital's waste was coming from the operating room. He says what seems like a simple recycling initiative can become complicated quickly because of how regulated the OR is. For example, all materials coming in and out of the room have to be accounted for. After working on this program for a bit, the blue wrap now has a specific path from the ORs on the third floor to a loading dock located on the west side of the hospital.
So right now we're down on the ground floor. The material gets generated up on the third floor, so it has to make the trip down the elevator into the central processing area, where we'll then get sorted out and brought outside.
On the loading dock, the hospital's waste is separated into different bins. Medical waste is disposed into red containers that are placed on some metal shelving. Cardboard is placed into one bin, paper and plastic are both placed into another, and trash is placed in yet another dumpster. The blue wrap, which is tied up in clear plastic bags, is placed into one of two smaller metal bins sitting on the dock. Swearingen says the blue wrap is regulated, so it can't be remanufactured into the same sterile wrap, but it can be made into other items like a dog bowl, a park bench, or even a recycle can. Before all that can happen, though, the material has to be hauled off and sold to a buyer. That's where the Benton County Solid Waste District comes in.
It's a number 5 polypropylene plastic wrap, and what this is used for is to keep the equipment sterile as it goes pre-case into the room. And once the equipment is inside a sterile environment, they're able to unwrap it. That wrap is then placed in the recycle container where previously it would go into the trash. But it's a very desirable plastic. People want it. Unfortunately, it's bulky and it's a little light, so it's not easily diverted into an amount that people are willing to pick up a lot of times, which is where we were able to partner with the Benton County Solid Waste District and bring them in as the people that actually haul the material.
Swearingen says once the hospital fills its bins, the Benton County Solid Waste District will pick up the blue wrap and store the material in one of its facilities. Once there is enough material to create a load, the Waste District will send it out of state to a buyer. Swearingen says this program, which is the first of its kind in Arkansas and one of only a handful in the region, really highlights the Waste District's commitment to forming local partnerships that create a good value for Benton County businesses. He says the program also highlights Mercy's commitment to sustainability. Since opening in 2008, Mercy's Rogers Hospital has received the Energy Star label from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency 5 times. In addition to using less energy, Rick Barclay, Vice President in Administration at Mercy Hospital in Rogers, says he thinks they are doing things that are pretty creative in the healthcare industry.
With lighting, you know, we've gone to a lot of automatic shutoff and light harvesting to where we're blessed with a really bright building with lots of windows. And so we have gained, we feel like we're doing very well in our energy management by seeing the lights that shut off automatically after a certain number of minutes. Motion detectors in certain areas like bathrooms. And we recycle batteries, we recycle cardboard, and then we also really discourage printing. We've moved, you know, to electronic health record. We have where people can access their record online. So we've watched our printing really, really reduce, and we've established a day of the week, which is No Print Thursday, where we ask people, do not print unless you absolutely have to.
Adding the blue wrap recycling program to the hospital's sustainability practices will help Mercy Northwest Arkansas reduce waste and save money. Barclay explains they have to pay a fee each time the trash dumpster is pulled. Originally, the dumpster had to be pulled a couple of times a week, but Barclay says he thinks they can get that down to once a week, which would save them about $250 every week. While cost savings are important to a business, Barclay says doing the right thing is also valuable.
You know, we try to look at the cost side, but we also, as we have a sister of Mercy, Sister Anita DeSalvo, who participates on our green team, she continues talking about us being a good steward of the earth, and it's just the right thing to do, and it fits the Mercy charisms. And so we do look at a return on investment, but we also look at, we try to do things because it's the right thing to do as well.
For more information, you can visit mercy.net/northwestarar, or you can visit p3wc.com.
If you've ever taken a golf lesson, you're familiar with the advice to bend the knees, keep your head down, and follow through. Here's some more advice handed out during a golf lesson earlier this week.
What's an open-ended question again?
A question that does not have yes or no for an answer.
So it's something that requires...
Jason Kaufman, golf coach, is teaching his young pupils how to introduce themselves to new people. He uses a three-letter mnemonic to help them recall the proper sequence, A-L-R, ask, listen, respond. The five steps include a firm handshake, making eye contact, asking the person's name, telling them yours, and asking an open-ended question to further the conversation. And yes, this is a golf lesson.
We'll assign them, practice those five steps with somebody at home, at school, or, you know, somebody that might come across in the grocery store, as long as it's not kind of awkward. Don't want them talking to strangers, but you do want them to be able to introduce themselves, and you want them... And for most kids, week one, this was pretty tough for them, you know. And then the last few weeks, we've made them do this with people outside the group, somebody they're not comfortable with. And so everybody's gotten better with it as the month has gone on.
What does this have to do with golf? At First Tee of Northwest Arkansas, the emphasis is more on life lessons and core values like honesty, respect, and perseverance than on correcting a slice or getting out of a sand trap. First Tee wants to use golf as an agent for learning and as a three-dimensional metaphor for better living. Learning how to carry a conversation with someone you just met can help later in college or in the professional world. Along with those nine core values taught is some golf. Mike Shea is the executive director of the First Tee of Northwest Arkansas, located in Lowell. He's been involved with golf course management for several years and with youth golf at each course. He says he was drawn to the First Tee concept soon after learning about it.
And without youth playing golf, there's not going to be golf. And so that's one facet that intrigues me. The other facet is at the First Tee, we're not just talking about golf, which no matter where the kids are from or how much money they come from or don't have or whatever, all of them can use the skills and the core values that golf teaches.
First Tee exists nationally, but each local chapter is independently operated. The facility in Lowell has been at the end of East Monroe Street for 3 years and has a driving range, a putting green, and more. Elizabeth Pringer, the director of outreach, can show off the entire 34 acres with a quick trip by golf cart.
This is our first hole right here. We have three different tee boxes that you can hit from. So some people will come and do three laps, and they'll do the full front nine or what have you.
The First Tee of Northwest Arkansas operates on a combination of sponsorships from corporations and from public use and public donations. The three-hole course and driving range can be accessed by the public for relatively inexpensive fees. A bucket of balls for the driving range is $8, and a round on the three-hole course is just $6. Some days, the paying public mixes nicely with the students. Elizabeth says there are a few days when the course hosts a field day with local fourth graders.
They come out between 8:30 and 2, and they go through different stations around the course with our coaches and our volunteer coaches, and they really get a fun experience with golf, which otherwise they may not have that exposure to the game.
For those field days, everything is paid for, from the bus transportation to and from school to lunch and snacks. 13 schools, from Owl Creek in Fayetteville to Cooper Elementary in Bella Vista and several in between, are participating this spring. The classes, held once a week for a month, are $25 a month, and held at the First Tee course. A course, by the way, specially designed for the location and the clientele. David Welchel co-designed the course with Executive Director Mike Shea and says it's not as demanding as most golf courses.
Case in point out here is on the right side of the first hole. I had a sand trap designed on the right side of the first hole, and Mike said, no, let's take that out of there. So maybe the kids don't get frustrated because the sand shot is one of the hardest shots in golf. So you try to keep it fun, try to keep it reachable for them. That's why we have all kinds of tees out there in different places, so they can get out there and hit it and find it and hit it again and finish the round. When they finish with a smile on their face, you've done something right.
Keeping frustration to a minimum. And if you've ever set a ball into water or putted seven times on the same green, you know golf can be frustrating. Keeping that frustration is a priority. Some of those core values taught through the program are confidence and perseverance. Again, Executive Director Mike Shea.
So we teach them how not to get frustrated. We teach them how to overcome problems on the golf course and in life. And so that's how that all works hand in hand.
And there is a mnemonic device for lessening frustration, the four R's. Replay, relax, ready, and redo. One of the coaches at First Tee, Brian Thomas, says beyond that, they teach a skill known as personal pars.
You know, you have a golf course, you have a par 3, a par 4, and a par 5. But we talk about how to set your own personal par, like whether or not you can get a 6 or a 7. And that's your own par that you set, not somebody else's set for you. So we talk about that, so not getting frustrated that you can't make it in a, you know, par 3 or par 4 or par 5.
Brian began playing golf with his father when he was 5, though he says there was nothing like First Tee to help him then. David Welchel, the co-designer of the course, began his relationship with the game later when he was a 20-year-old college student studying poultry science at the University of Arkansas. He had grown up in Huntsville before that town had a golf course.
And I do remember I shot 121, and I was hooked.
That was 18.
That was 18 holes. Yeah. Shot 61 the front nine and 60 the second
nine. You got better.
Yep, I improved. And I went that weekend. I couldn't afford new clubs. A struggling college student like so many of us were. I found some in a garage sale and gave $40 for a set of golf clubs, a cart, and a bag. And I've been hooked since.
So he says he can relate to the young golfers from ages 7 to 17 enrolled in First Tee classes. And First Tee tries to make the introduction to golf inexpensive. Classes are $25 a month, clubs can be borrowed from the facility, and membership in the classes allows the young golfers access to area 9-hole Lindsay golf courses and some courses in Bella Vista for just a dollar a round. Elizabeth Pringer says if that's still too much money to spend for the child, there are scholarships available.
One Angel scholarship is a value of about $300. So we have a lot of our associate members sign up to be an associate member at that capacity on the $300 level to help fund that Angel scholarship program. And then also you can come in and invest $25, get discounted prices here at the clubhouse, and that also goes to the Angel scholarship as well.
And there's evidence the classes make a lasting difference.
I'm Hannah Brauberger.
While the under 12 class was learning about introductions and how to make a chip shot, Hannah was practicing at the driving range. She began with First Tee when she was 8 years old. That was 9 years ago. She says she still remembers the 9 core values being taught to her.
Yeah, because I teach them now. It's so weird, you know, going from actually learning them to teaching them.
So how many of you guys had a chance to practice a life skill last week? You remember what it is? Hopefully.
You can learn more about First Tee of Northwest Arkansas and the Tyson Foods First Tee Learning Center in Lowell at the website TNWAR.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, it is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back. What do you got for me today?
Glad to be back, Kyle. And sometimes you just have to shake your head. I swear to you, this is a true story.
Okay.
I overheard the conversation of a millennial and his late baby boomer era coworker in a cafeteria. He says to the friend, as they look up at the television screen, "What does this JFK mean to me? They're acting like he's some kind of celebrity. What's the big deal? Him being president, he doesn't mean anything to me."
All right. I know that you wouldn't tell me this if it wasn't true, but this sounds just like some bad television trope of a slacker character.
Oh, yeah. Some Bill O'Reilly nightmare of the under-educated American youth run wild. But and we've repeatedly said this here. This is not something unique to this generation.
Right.
About every generation appears to know little about its common past, and every generation's elder rails about kids these days.
So is this a 911 call to a historian? Did you run over and administer the paddles to the chest and say, here's...
You know, I thought about it, and at the same time, one wonders if the historic impact of that genuine first ever that rarely comes along, mm-hmm. has sunk in on this young man that he probably voted in his first presidential election this cycle or the cycle before, and he was a part of the generation that yielded the first African-American to occupy the Oval Office.
True.
In some ways, he might be too close to see what he was a part of, but just the right distance away to not understand what he was watching on TV. Perhaps one way to frame his perspective was the equal befuddlement that he had in talking when he said to his friend, why is the video black and white and sometimes it's in color?
He said that. So
he said that.
So did he think it was some sort of video editing or?
Well, sure, he's seen that on Instagram filters, so I'm sure that's why he thought they were doing it, that, you know, why wouldn't all the video have been in color?
So it never hit him that there was a time before video when the pictures hadn't been in color?
It was a classic, I don't know what he doesn't know kind of moment. You know, did he really see it that way? But he was genuinely, befuddled
by it. Okay, this brings up a good point, because you don't want to sound like those guys on The Muppet Show that are in the balcony.
Yeah.
You don't want to...
You don't have a Statler and Waldorf moment?
Those guys, yeah. You don't want to wag your finger, because that's not going to do anything. So what do?
You know, in part, he's a victim of the knowledge valley that I think exists, particularly in high school history today. You've got a generation of teachers that grew up not necessarily learning all the details of the latter half of the 20th century because it was still current events to their instructors when they were getting their doctorates in college.
Right.
There's always been this kind of lag. I mean, I experienced it when it had to deal with the end of the Second World War and the Cold War because, you know, there was that generational lag in the people that taught me when I was in college. So, you know, there's always this recent history little valley sometimes in the knowledge base, and then that gets passed on.
But isn't there an opportunity? Because we did have the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. We're dealing every month, it seems, with the 150th anniversary of something with the Civil War. Isn't there a chance with anniversaries to kind of connect?
There is, and the end of a very significant one, Mad Men.
The TV show.
Yes.
All right. Okay. I love that series. And it is about to start. It's not that far away from ending its final season. So tell me, how does Don Draper fit into this?
Okay.
I know you will tell me.
What made Mad Men so successful?
Oh, just it was like a window on a previous time.
The series wove the historical events into a truth told through fiction.
Right.
Of the changes of the 1960s and the 1970s, the exact time period of
Camelot, the Kennedys.
Bingo. And civil rights and great American unrest and the Beatles' arrival in America notwithstanding, this year does begin a series of not so golden anniversaries. JFK's assassination in 63 begats a litany of 50th, the Gulf of Tonkin, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King.
So we should set people down, maybe young people, for a binge-watching series of Mad Men?
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
But taking advantage of what's about to flow across the television the rest of this year and into the next few, you know, I could say that we both remember when the History Channel actually used to carry history.
Yes.
And I know you know when music television actually meant music on television. So, you know, watch the offerings on your Kindles and in the bookstores. More and more popular histories are going to start recapping these events that fill that little valley that this individual has in his knowledge base. Taking an active interest in why the president was important to you, and I'm going to make an assumption here, minimum wage worker.
Because you're young and, yeah.
Because he was the first president, Kennedy, since FDR to raise and broaden the minimum wage. Who raised the minimum wage first for government workers when he did it, who raised it by 25% over 2 years of his administration. That's something that directly relates to the political contest underway today with the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, as he tries to lift the minimum wage by a similar percentage, but he's trying to lift it to $10. So who was JFK? The conservative who said a rising tide lifts all ships and cut taxes? Or the progressive that felt it was okay to raise a $1 minimum wage set in 1938 to $1.25? That's the 25% increase. This is what our young man needs to dive into and begin to understand about why that guy was being treated like a celebrity.
Well, until that young guy asks us what we can do for our country,
we're history.
When Amy Webb turned 30, she decided to find her true love on an online dating site. And to do it right, she hacked the algorithm to find the perfect man.
And as it turns out, I was the most popular person online.
Stories of how we love. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen Sunday at noon to 91.3 FM.
It is Sunday, April 27th, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm going to talk about sort of classical music, about which I generally know nothing. I don't either.
All right, let's hear.
But Stephen Caldwell, who is the director of choral activities at the University of Arkansas, is a brilliant interview. If I was half as eloquent as he is, this would be a great segment. What's interesting that he's doing now is he's taken four university choirs.
200 voices, right?
200 voices, plus a kids' choir from Central Junior High in Springdale.
Right.
And the UA Percussion Ensemble.
Yeah.
And three soloists.
Yeah.
And he's put them all together to do Carmina Burana tonight.
Which is a stunning work to hear live.
And he says it's one of those ubiquitous pieces that everybody knows even if they don't know it. Mm-hmm. It's the music that's played in movies when the volcano blows up.
The Omen, right? Didn't The Omen make good use of it?
I think every movie, there's a list 8 feet long of all the movies it's been in. Yes.
Yes.
It's actually, it was written in the mid-30s by a German composer named Karl Orff.
Right.
Based on a medieval codex, which means book, discovered in 1803. And upon its completion, Orff reportedly said, "Everything I have written to date and which you have unfortunately printed can be destroyed. With Carmina Burana, my collected works begin."
So he was proud of his achievement.
Very. And there was some controversy about it being played at first because this was going into World War II. He was German. So it didn't really get played a lot on our side of the world until after some of that had cooled off.
So a really relatively recent history.
Exactly. It's 25 movements and 233 voices total, maybe. He says he's directed it as a chamber piece, and it's fine, but you have to give the audience what they expect, which is boom.
Well, yeah.
So it'll be a great deal of fun, and he hopes it will bring in people who have no interest in choral music to see what it is.
Is this in Stella Boyle?
No, it's at the Walton Arts Center.
Walton Arts Center. Wow, it's really going to reverberate.
Well, 7:30 tonight. Oh. Yeah, 7:30 tonight. There was no place for them to rehearse together on the UA campus.
Well,
they all shoved themselves into the band room.
No.
For one rehearsal. Because all the choirs rehearsed separately.
Right.
And then they all came together for one rehearsal on campus. And they all tried to squeeze into the big band room.
Fantastic.
And then there's going to be one rehearsal today.
Sure.
At the Walton Arts Center. But there was no place on campus big enough to rehearse.
All right.
So that should tell you the epic scope of this undertaking.
The enormity of it all.
And at 7:30 tonight, you can get in and hear this for $5. Five. Skip your latte. Also this afternoon, the last performance of As You Like It at the University of Arkansas, one of Shakespeare's great comedies. That's at 2 o'clock. And Hamlet continues at Theater Squared at 2 and 7 today. So if you want to do Little Shakespeare, Little Carmina Burana, you could do it all for $21.
And pretty much on foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina, you are younger than me.
Yes.
That's firmly established. So this week marked the 25th anniversary of Game Boy.
Yeah.
Now, did that have a role in your life? Were you ever a Game Boy player?
I don't think I ever actually had a Game Boy, but I remember I had friends that did.
And Game Boy was a handheld, right?
Version of Nintendo.
So it took a lot of those games that were popular on television and brought them down into and really began the revolution of handheld video games.
The game I remember playing most on Game Boy was Tetris.
Yes. I know many people who still can kind of almost become addicted to moving the shapes, and I was never good at that game. Bring this all up. Not to go down memory lane with you about Game Boy, but because this week did mark the 25th anniversary of the release of Game Boy, our colleague Antoinette Grajeda was inspired to create this week's Sunday montage. And so here are clips that relate to video games.
Its name is Pikachu.
Oh, it's so cute. It's the best of all.
You'll see.
Oh, hi, Pikachu.
Pika.
It's also known as Electric Mouse. It's usually shy, but can sometimes have an electrifying personality.
I see what you mean.
Shocking, isn't it?
It's you, it's all for you.
Computer turns them into sound.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed them.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
Standing in the cavern of the evil wizard. All around you, the carcasses of slain ice dwarves. Melt wizard. What do you want to melt him with?
God!
What do you think I want to melt him with?
My name's Ralph, and I'm a bad guy. Let's see. I'm 9 feet tall. I weigh 643 pounds. Got a little bit of a temper on me.
Hey, you moved my stump!
My passion bubbles very near the surface, I guess. Not gonna lie. Anywho, what else? I'm a wrecker. I wreck things, professionally.
I'm gonna wreck it!
I mean, I'm very good at what I do. Probably the best I know.
In there, I'm going to tell you one of the clips. It was a song called Pac-Man Fever. It was a huge hit when it came out by the duo Buckner and Garcia. I happened to be a DJ at the time, and I would work 6 to midnight, and between 6 and 7 every night, I'd have dozens of calls from adolescents wanting to hear that song.
Well, they must have been at the arcade playing.
I'm sure they
were. Playing their games.
If people want to know all the clips, identify all of what they heard, where can they go?
OzarksAtLarge.com.
We'll be right back.
Most of us must seek out the services of a notary public to affix their stamp onto our important documents after we sign them. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, Arkansas Secretary of State, which holds notary oversight, has approved the use of e-notarization.
A notary public acts as an official and unbiased witness to the identity of an individual who, for example, is giving a written testimony or signing a legal document. Danielle Fosco is a special projects coordinator for the Business and Commercial Services Division for the Arkansas Secretary of State, which regulates the state's notaries.
We have about 60,000 commissioned notaries in Arkansas currently for all sorts of documents, you know, mortgage documents, some school documents. I competed in the Miss Arkansas pageant system, and even my applications for that system, those had to be notarized as well. So there's multiple documents where, you know, verification is key and identity is key on these important documents.
And up until this month, notary transactions were strictly done on paper.
Someone will find a notary. They come to you in person with their hard copy printed documents. They take a simple pen. They sign their name. The notary verifies identity through a driver's license, some other form of photo identification. The notary then signs that document as well with pen and then stamps it with a rubber stamp. It's just very, very simple.
On April 2nd, Arkansas Secretary of State Mark Martin announced that Arkansas would be implementing electronic notarization of documents. E-notarization involves affixing an electronic digital signature and notary seal to notarize digital documents validated with a digital certificate.
It's the secretary's initiative. He's the one who brought this to us about a year ago and said, this is what I want to do. It is the year 2014, and technology has changed. Times have changed. As I mentioned before, verification is key in protecting identities, especially with identity theft on the rise. And e-notary has more protections in place. It uses what's called public key infrastructure, which uses complex mathematical algorithms and hashing. It essentially encrypts documents. So we now have the ability to encrypt documents, further preventing fraud, as well as eliminating paper from the transaction as a whole. You know, many things nowadays are done electronically, submitted electronically, and this takes paper out of the equation completely if the parties so choose.
Fosco says that e-notarization is a varied process.
The client could come to a notary with a hard copy of a document. In that case, the notary would scan the document into a system, probably creating a PDF. It would make the document electronic. The e-notary would then log into a web portal. All this is done through a web portal. They would log in with an identifying name of some sort as well as a password. So they've got their first step for the notary to prove they are who they are by logging into the system, the secure system. The notary would then go in and have to follow, it's kind of a wizard, of steps to, you know, verify the identity of the signer. In that case, some of these portals even require the notary to enter specific information about the signer's identification, such as what's the name printed on it, maybe the last four digits of a driver's license. So we've got a step that's further proving that the person's appearing before the notary.
The notary's electronic digital signature would be pre-created or entered by keyboard, Fosco says, and the customer would also enter their signature through a keyboard or signature pad, whichever is available.
And would then go digitally onto that document. The notary would then enter their signature once again, either through a keyboard or through a signature pad, and it would then appear on that document electronically. And the notary's seal of office, which would require all of the same information as the rubber stamp, it would be a digital image that would be dragged and dropped onto that document. And you would then save the document from there. You can either print it off, secure it, or save it in a secure vault type system. You could email the document. But once those signatures are placed on that document and that digital seal is placed on there, those have certain forms of encryption with them to where if anything is modified after it's signed, even removing a period from the document, doing anything to it, would then flag that document as being tampered with or possibly forged. So you can then submit it electronically. The other step, same steps. Say someone brings you a document on a flash drive. You would just upload it into your computer and do those same steps from there. or the client can email the document to the notary. But like with a regular notary, the client still has to appear personally before the notary in their presence.
E-notarization standards were first approved by the National Association of Secretaries of State in 2006, then offered to states for voluntary adoption. The standards require that electronic signature is unique to the notary, capable of independent authentication, retained under the notary's sole control and attached to or logically associated with the electronic document. At least 18 states have adopted e-notarization. Personal appearance before the notary is still required in Arkansas, although Virginia is the first state to authorize remotely witnessed e-notarization utilizing web-based audiovisual technology. And any Arkansas notary public in good standing is eligible to apply to become an e-notary.
You can go to our website, which is sos.arkansas.gov. You would then go to the Business and Commercial Services link and find the electronic notary link. And on there, there is an application. You submit that application to us along with a $20 fee. We'll process it, and you can then sign up for our mandatory training. There is a mandatory training for this because there is so much technology involved and it is so secure. We do have mandatory training and a short exam at the end. Once you've done that, you can then go sign up with a solution provider of your choice. We have two approved solution providers so far. They are Doc Verify and Worldwide Notary, and they have two different types of systems that they use. So it depends on the e-notaries, what they want to use, if they want to use a web portal or go with that signature pad. It's a very simple process, and your e-notary commission lasts throughout your traditional commission.
A notary can charge up to $5 per paper or electronic document. E-notaries will also incur a small surcharge for each electronic transaction or pay a monthly fee to their e-notary vendor.
Our companies up here in Mountain Home, where I'm currently sitting, actually contacted us and said, when this goes live, we will save $800 a month on printing costs alone. So the little bit extra fee that it costs to be an e-notary pays off in the long run when you're saving on those paper and printing costs.
As well as trees. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Last Roots Festival, last August, I saw a band that I absolutely loved.
You raved about.
I did. I had never heard of them before. Elephant Revival.
And they have stopped here more than once, not just at the Fayetteville Roots Festival. Earlier this year, they were at George's Majestic Lounge.
Harvest Fest.
Harvest Fest. They've been at Wakarusa. Last night, they were at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. They're based in Colorado, though they have some of the band members have familial connections with Tahlequah and Rogers and Northwest Arkansas. When they were here the first time this year, it was during our fundraiser. They were going to do a show that night at George's. It was a Sunday. They had just literally pulled in from a show at Lawrence, Kansas, were nice enough to come into the Furman Garner Performance Studio, a bit groggy, a bit tired, but sat down with Antoinette and myself, and they played some songs, and this is one of them. I think it's my favorite song they do. It's called Rogue River.
See, they're down at the liquor store going to drink those troubles and some more down at the old Rogue River. That old Rogue River. Down at the old Rogue River. That old Rogue River. You were daddy's sunshine days. He left for good, went down to his grave. Mother Mary, full of grace, won't you watch these children in my place? I'm going under the river, that old Rogue River. I'm going under the river, that old Rogue River. Seems that nothing could be said by song. There's a fire in the little ones, Lord, and it burns high, Lord, and it burns bright. She leaps in pain, goes love and light, watching over her and sisters to mama and papa. God, angels will have to do for now. Lord, have mercy in my dying days. There's been much shame. Left my babies in the cold. Now my heart it aches. I've been growing old. Feel it rise up into my throat. Lay these troubles down. Lift my soul. I'm going to pray forgiveness. Let me go. Pray my children and their children know not to do what I have done, but let go. Lay these troubles down. Lift my soul. Lift my soul. Lift my soul up and over the river. That old rogue river. Lift up and over the river. That old rogue river.
Elephant Revival inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio, the song Rogue River.
American cellist Alyssa Weilerstein made her Decca debut featuring Elgar's Cello Concerto. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Note, Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KUAF. Join me for Elgar's Cello Concerto from Alyssa Weilerstein and the Staatskapelle Berlin, led by Daniel Barenboim.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Lincoln.
Lincoln, over on the other side of Cane Hill.
That's right, on the western Washington County.
I have to think, on the other side of Cane Hill if you're coming from Fayetteville. So.
You know how you know someone has either lived here a while or does a job like you do when they refer to something as the other side of Cane Hill? There's not a lot of, you know, Cane Hill isn't the marker for a lot of people.
True.
There's nothing wrong with that. I like it, actually.
Well, I've been there at least twice for stories. Last year, I was there for the annual kite fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the top of Cane Hill. Well, a hill in Cane
right,
Hill.
Yeah. Right. Cane Hill has some really interesting history, of course. I mean, Civil War and before and after.
And they're in the middle, I think, of a really big project to
they
try
are.
To revitalize some of those old yeah. buildings and cemeteries and things.
Is there a community in our listening area that you haven't been to that you want to get to? Have you ever been to Figure Five?
No.
Sometime when you go to Siloam Springs, then, you know, I think it's Highway 59 that you, instead of taking 49 over to 40. If you take, I think, Highway 59 south, you go through Figure 5.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. There's so many. And usually it's like when I'm driving to Cane Hill and I see something
right.
and I'm like, oh, I really need to remember that.
Right.
Or, you know, I went to Berryville, I think, last summer and passed through a town I'd never heard of. And I'm mm-hmm. like, I need to remember that. So I really need to remember them.
Well, when I was at First Tee this past week, working on that story in Lowell, you know, you're headed down East Monroe, and the first Tee of Northwest Arkansas is at the end of East Monroe. But if you were to take the left, you'd go to downtown Lowell. I haven't been to downtown Lowell in a long time. I need to go back to downtown Lowell.
I can't remember the last time I was in downtown L.A.
That's right. Let's see. You have the program tomorrow.
I do. What do we have on the show tomorrow? I'm trying to remember.
A conversation I had about lasers with a visiting professor of the University of Arkansas Physics Department brought in. And kind of how lasers have changed our life, and there are a lot of ways we don't know. Fascinating conversation.
I know Antoinette Grajeda spoke with somebody about some recent awards in the River Valley.
Yes, the GRIT Awards that are given for hospitality and entertainment and representation of Fort Smith. So that's on tomorrow as well. And Antoinette and I will be back on Tuesday, and I'm going to go away for
a
week.
You're going to Louisiana.
Yes, New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
We'll miss you, but I'm sure you'll have a great time.
Well, I'm going to see Bruce Springsteen, so...
You'll have a great time. One of your favorites. The favorite.
Probably, yes. I think that's fair to say. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. And again, Christina will be with you tomorrow at noon for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.
Until then, have a good Sunday.